I'm very happy now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Los Alamos physicists Greg Swift and Rajan Gupta. Welcome, gentlemen, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
Thank you very much.
We're talking today about energy, climate, and economic development, and how those three things really weave together. Why don't we talk about where we're at energy-wise? We are still a fossil fuel-based nation and a fossil fuel-dependent world, and we are undergoing climate change at a rate that is perhaps more rapid than we had thought it was even 5-10 years ago. Is that correct?
Yes, it is. What's happening is that the processes keep accelerating. So if we were putting, say, each person was putting in 1,000 pounds of junk out, say even in terms of their waste disposal, today they are putting out 1,200 pounds. So the whole process is accelerating because our lifestyles are producing more greenhouse gases, more disposable goods, more waste, and so that whole process is accelerating.
I think you can see that in the statistics for the year 2011. I think the global emissions of carbon dioxide rose 3% in 2011 relative to 2010. The population only went up maybe about 1%, so the difference, 2%, is the rise in global economic activity reliant on fossil fuels.
Now, this is extraordinary given the fact that there is, even in the United States, where there's been a tremendous PR campaign against acknowledgement of global warming and climate change, there is a worldwide consciousness that we've got a problem, and all kinds of people, including, I'm sure, all three of us at this table and many, many of our listeners, are trying to do what they can to conserve energy, and yet the problem is still accelerating. Why is conservation not doing the trick?
There are a number of reasons. First, many more people today have a higher standard of living because of the growth in countries like China or India, Brazil, or even Africa. So when more people are aspiring to higher standards of living, the consumption goes up and therefore the output goes up. The second is even in countries, if you look at, say, the United States or Europe, the growth in technology, which allows improvements in efficiency, is not keeping pace with the growth in expectations and therefore consumption.
So, what do you mean by that?
What I mean by that is, take, for example, electronics. So clearly today we have far more efficient televisions in terms of their consumption of energy. We have LCDs, we have flat panel televisions. So on a per television basis, each television is consuming less energy than, say, the tubes which were there 20 years ago.
Right, and which I still have in my living room.
On the other hand, what's happened is, today, a typical house has 3 televisions and 2 computers and stereo systems, many of which are on for 6, 8, 12 hours a day. And so if you now add those things up, so we've made tremendous progress in reducing the footprint of each individual item, but we have our lifestyles have meant that we want 10 of those. And so the net result is that we are using more energy than we were using 10 years ago.
So really, one of the things that I think we have to understand is that it's not just about making energy-efficient appliances. It's about just using what you need and no more than that.
Right.
What we're faced with in the United States is a situation where our entire lifestyle depends on the consumption of a lot of energy, 80% of which comes from fossil fuel today. And it's not just the gasoline we put in our cars and the coal that makes the electricity that we use in our homes and our in our workplaces. But everything that we buy, even food, has a huge amount of energy built into it. And so even food consumption is adding to our carbon footprints on this earth.
I think because the food comes from so far away, for example.
That's part of it, but part of it is fertilizer and pesticide manufacture. Let's see if I remember some of the numbers. 15% of America's energy supply goes into food. If that's food production, food processing in the factories, transport to market, then the heating and air conditioning of the supermarkets, the energy we use in our homes to keep the refrigerator going that stores the food and to cook the food. That all adds up to about 15%.
Very interesting. And so part of what we're doing today is giving people this information just so that they can make choices and think about, for example, whether they want to buy their food locally and what is involved in using, for example, like, I wonder what the numbers would be if you bought all your food locally, your beef and if you eat beef, or your meat and your vegetables and all of that stuff, as much as possible locally from organic farms that didn't use pesticides or fertilizers. You still have to drive it home, and you still probably have to keep it in the refrigerator, but you'd be cutting down the footprint of that food considerably, wouldn't you?
That's all a step in the right direction. But, you know, when you start trying to figure out all of the ways that energy sneaks into everything we do and try to do a calculation of what your decisions should be on a daily or even hourly basis, it'll drive you crazy.
Right.
And this is one of the reasons why we really have to push for policy change in the country so that these pros and cons are somehow built into the prices of things that we buy, and the decisions we make will more naturally favor the environment.
But the problem, I think, is deeper. So when you asked why is there so much energy used in food, so let's look at it this way. You buy a loaf of bread, say that loaf of bread weighs about 2 pounds. You need, that's almost all wheat. You need 1,000 times or 2,000 pounds of water to produce that 2 pounds of a loaf of bread. And then once you've grown the wheat, you've got to process it. You take it into a bakery, which is all today running on electric power. And then you transport it all over the country if it's a national brand. So at every step of the way, you are using energy. So go back to using water. Previously, you had water which was flowing under the force of gravity. Rivers were flowing, and you would use that water, or you would use rainwater for growing your crops. Today, you're using irrigation, which means you're using pumps, you're diverting rivers, and all that took energy. Every time you run a pump, you're putting, yes, you're growing more food, but you're also using more energy. So the process becomes complicated in terms of which is more efficient. Now, as I told you, it takes 1,000 times in weight the amount of water for producing a certain amount of, say, a loaf of bread. So think of the equivalent of a bread, which is, and 1,000 times that is the amount of water. But now if you wanted to eat meat, and you wanted to eat lean meat, which is healthy for you, you add another factor of 22. So first of all, the cow eats the grass. It processes a certain fraction of it. That gets converted into fat. And then you throw away all the scrap, all the stuff, so that you have lean meat. So you are looking at 22,000 times the weight of that steak which you eat. So if you get a 6-ounce steak, you multiply that by 22,000. And that is almost 5 tons of water which has gone into it.
It seems almost impossible that we have a system that functions at all. When you look, I mean, you have to really look at those numbers and how much, I mean, a gallon of water weighs 8 pounds and how much rain falls and how much you're taking out of the aquifer in a state like New Mexico. But that's a crazy amount. How did we get here?
Well, part of it is technology. Each year we find more efficient processes. As I said, initially human beings had no pumps, so you were only using water which flowed. Now you have pumps, so you're able to, the same piece of land in, say, New Mexico, if it was totally reliant on just rain and river water, or just rain, versus if you had either access to river water or pumped water, you can produce 8-10 times the amount of food on that same amount of land. So as technology came by, it allowed us to do things which were efficient, which high yields and stuff. But at some level, it hit us, because in order to sustain that, the ground could no longer replenish those nutrients. Now you started to have to put in fertilizers. So at every level, as you accelerated the process, you wanted to get more out of it, you had to put more and more and more energy. But energy was so cheap, then nobody thought about it. So you'd never said, hey, I'm putting in so much fertilizer. Huh, it's cheap. I can buy a bag of fertilizer for a pound, and that 1 pound brings me 1,000 pounds of wheat. So it was very cost effective. It was such a small fraction of the cost.
And it was fossil fuel that made all of that technology so cheap for us for a century.
All fertilizer is
it's astounding that 10 cents worth of electricity will do so much. It'll run your toaster oven for 15 minutes, long enough to make a piece of toast. It's only 10 cents worth of electricity. And that only takes, I don't know, a fraction of a pound of coal being burned in the power plant. But, you know, you add up all the people running light bulbs and toaster ovens and fans and air conditioners all around the country, and all the coal that's being burned, and all of a sudden we're having these unforeseen environmental consequences that we have to start paying attention to.
We're talking to physicists Greg Swift and Rajan Gupta. So unforeseen consequences, now they've been seen. Let's take a look at what some of those consequences are. Sum up for us what we're seeing globally.
Rajan and I are the most concerned about climate change, I think, because the 2 or 3 degrees Fahrenheit temperature rise that humanity has caused in the last century from burning all of our fossil fuel is really just the start of what we're already committed to and what might get much, much worse. The trouble with climate change and carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is that the lifetime of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is so long. The processes that remove it on a short time scale, like photosynthesis, are fundamentally limited in the ability to cope with what we're doing. And the processes that can take out the large quantities of carbon dioxide that we're putting in, such as minerals absorbing CO2 from the atmosphere and turning them into carbonate minerals, are things that take place over millennia. So what we're doing today in terms of burning fossil fuel is taking carbon out of the earth that has been there for 100 million years or more as fossil fuel, putting it in the atmosphere, and having no way for nature to take it back out of the atmosphere.
Big problem. So either you've got to find ways to take it out at a much more rapid rate than we're able to do now through these natural processes. Even our forests can't do the job. Or we've got to just stop producing so much of it. Are those our two choices?
So let me, I mean, I want to take back, even though, yes, the answer is yes. even though Greg rightly said we are focused on climate change, but I want to use the older example of environment because there's a lesson here. Let's, for the sake of example, in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, Pittsburgh had the reputation of being a very highly polluted city. And that's because there were a lot of steel mills and coal-fired power plants in its vicinity that were producing a lot of soot. They were producing a lot of smoke and haze. And so it was very polluted. And rightly so, at that point, people saw that. And there was this tussle between welfare, which is economic development, and a loss of quality of life, which was the fact that they were living in a highly polluted city. But at some point, through education, through realization, people said, look, we don't have to do this. We can make better choices. So three things happened. One is that the coal-fired power plants and the industry became cleaner. They figured out processes which produce less pollution. The second is they became richer, so they could go retroactively and clean up the mess they had made. The third is much of that industry moved out of Pittsburgh. So the steel mills left, they became richer. Those jobs got replaced by banking jobs or by other kinds of service industry. So the city starts to clean up. And today, if you go to Pittsburgh, you would never imagine that the pictures of Pittsburgh in the 50s or 60s. But three things had to happen. One is technology showed you cleaner ways of doing things. Secondly, you had the ability to go back and clean up and help nature replenish, and there was no significant long-term legacy.
Except probably the people who got sick from it.
Yes, yes. That I'm not counting those. I'm just saying in terms of those who are seeing it today. And the third thing is you got rid of the highest polluting aspects of that. So as Greg said, technology, yes, we are working hard. So solar and wind, these are improvements we are making, which are bringing in clean technology versus polluting technology at the same level. The second part, which Greg emphasized, is we have no retroactive way of cleaning up carbon dioxide. So nature is really our only hope. So we have to wait for the natural timescale. And how can nature clean up carbon dioxide? It can be absorbed by plants into plant matter, which means more greenery, more fossil forests and stuff. It can, a much lower process than that is where minerals or rock, exposed rocks react and change silicates into carbonates, which Greg said. And the third is oceans absorb that. But here is the problem. If you have huge growth of forests and you don't have a similar growth in the water and moisture, you have higher forest fires in areas where if you incentivize the growth of that.
And then forest fires produce carbon dioxide and you're back to square one.
Yes. The second part is oceans, which is the other big absorber. The problem is, yes, they can absorb them, but if that water, if the carbon side stays in the surface water absorbed, then it leads to huge degradation of marine life. All your coral and everything is reacting with that increased acidity of the water.
So when you put carbon dioxide into the water, it becomes more acid. That's what they're talking about when you hear about acidification of the oceans.
Right. So again, that's bad. So there, the only way nature can help us is it recirculates that water and takes it deep in the seas so that it takes that carbon dioxide, moves the highly absorbed carbon dioxide absorbed water and takes it deeper down.
Does it do that naturally?
Yes, but the timescales are thousands to tens of thousands of years.
Right. And we've created this whole problem in less than 100 years.
We have a really good scientific record of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere for hundreds of thousands of years. The people who take ice samples in Antarctica, you know, the ice builds up in annual layers like tree rings, and they have drilled out cylinders of ice from Antarctica going back 400,000 or 500,000 years and looked at the air that got trapped when the snow fell.
Right.
And if you look at that record of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere for 400,000 years, it's always been between 180 and 280 parts per million until the industrial age came along 200 years ago when we started burning coal in factories and then later petroleum. So from 280, we've shot up already to 390 parts per million. All right. And the difference between 180 and 280, those variations in the ancient historical record, those are the difference between ice ages and the kind of global climate we have today.
And so the global climate we have today is more like 280?
The global climate we have today is due to having about 280 parts per million. So we're already past 380. So we've already committed to a climate that is as much warmer than today as the ice ages were colder than today. In round numbers,
right.
That's the sad fact of what we've already committed to by the fossil fuels we've already burned.
We're talking to Greg Swift and Rajan Gupta, physicists, about energy, climate, and economic development. So one thing that I think is also really important to talk about is the fact that the temperature increase that we had, let's say, from last year to this year is not the CO2 that we put into the air between last year and this year. It's CO2 that was put into the air, what, how many years ago?
Well, that's hard to say. So
it's a very complicated question and answer.
But the thing which, as both Greg and I, one of the things we'll discuss even in our course, is if you take a pot of water and you turn on the burner, the temperature of the water rises steadily. And at some point, the amount of heat you put in through the burner is equal to the amount of heat which is going out from the surface of your pot or from the water, from the top and stuff. But if you now take a time, it takes a certain amount of time from when you turn on the burner to when the water reaches that temperature of equilibrium where the heat coming in is equal to the heat going out.
Right.
Okay? And normally that happens because we put our burners very high, so the water starts boiling. But let's say you had it very, very low. But the thing which you have to, everybody appreciates and sees, is it takes a certain delay between when you turn on the burner and when the water reaches that equilibrium temperature.
It's the heat capacity of the water.
Right. Because the water takes a certain amount of heat which has to be accumulated to increase its temperature.
So when you put that analogy to atmosphere.
Right. So what happens is that the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is equivalent to turning up this heating, which normally would be the sun. And when you turn up the heat, it takes a certain amount of time because the Earth is huge for the Earth to adjust to that extra amount of heat. And so the temperature which you're seeing today, or the fluctuations or the fear about already seeing climate change, is reacting to the carbon dioxide, we think, which was already there till about, say, 30 years back. So that heating, which was forced because of that increased carbon dioxide, say, till 1980 or 75, that was sufficient to account for the heating, or the temperature we are seeing today. Everything we put after that is an additional heat, which is going to again give rise to more temperature increase. And so there is this lag. So what you're seeing is that we could be easily fooled into believing, hey, this is what we are seeing. This is what 390 parts per million is going to be responsible for. No, The only way you would know what 390 parts per million is responsible for, or final temperature, is if you stopped putting in any more carbon dioxide for 40 years, that level stayed at 390, and then you saw what the Earth came to equilibrium at.
Right.
So there's a shock waiting for us when you finally realize what the full potential of the carbon dioxide, which is already in the atmosphere. And as Greg pointed out, to first approximation, you have no remediation. Either you put it in forests or you put it in oceans. Humans cannot take it out at the moment. We have no ways, no real industrial scale applications which take out any significant fraction.
Because you would use up more energy taking it out than you would be
No, because there's nothing that uses, like, other than carbonated drinks like Coca-Cola. Mm-hmm. The industrial uses of carbon dioxide are zero, essentially.
Yeah, the quantities are just too vast. You know, every year we mine about a cubic kilometer of coal. So imagine a cube, a half a mile on each side and a half a mile tall of coal. That's carbon that nature took out of the atmosphere when the atmosphere had much more carbon dioxide in it hundreds of millions of years ago. Nature took that out of the atmosphere, made trees. The trees fell down before there were bacteria that could break down wood, and that all got buried and turned into fossil fuel. And there's just no way that nature can handle our burning of that much every year, year after year after year.
Just out of curiosity, when you talk about the volume of coal that we mine and burn every year, what is that in, like, pounds or tons?
So basically, Greg was right that worldwide we mine around 1 cubic mile of coal.
He said kilometer.
Well,
depending
on how dense the coal is, because different places have different density of coal, it's somewhere between half and one cubic mile. So if you think about it in that terms of a cubic mile, most people would say, hey, that's not very much. But that is about 8 billion tons of coal every year.
8 billion tons of coal every year.
Right.
Then that releases CO2, which goes into the atmosphere. And then either it's recaptured or it's not, and it's not.
Right.
And so we then have all these consequences, which is basically a warmer atmosphere, because when you think about the greenhouse effect, we use that word so much and we forget about the actual greenhouse. The greenhouse effect is what happens in every Santa Fe house with a southern exposure in the winter, which is your living room gets very warm, even though it's really cold outside. It traps the heat the way glass traps heat. And the environmental consequences are vast.
Right. So just to put that 8 billion tons of coal. So 8 billion tons of coal gives rise to about 16 billion tons of carbon dioxide. And
an equivalent amount from petroleum.
Yes.
And another equivalent amount from natural gas.
Right. So let's just take this coal part, which is 16 billion tons. That is giving rise to an increase of about 2 parts per million of carbon dioxide every year. So what you're seeing is that, yes, it might look small as a cubic kilometer or a cubic mile, but its consequences are it's putting in 2 parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere.
So every 50 years, another 100 parts.
Right. Mm-hmm. And 100 part is which we think at this point it is going to give rise to 1 degree centigrade or 1.5 degrees Fahrenheit increase in temperature. So think about it this way. Just what we are burning today, in 50 years, just coal would, if not taken care of, is going to give you 1.5 degrees Fahrenheit increase in temperature.
Comparable to what we've already experienced in historic times. So if you think about the cycles of drought and non-drought in New Mexico, riding on top of an ever-increasing baseline of higher temperatures, you can see why we can expect more and more forest fires and and more hot days and more just more extreme weather.
And more water stress.
And more water stress. And in fact, the things that we are actually seeing.
Starting to see.
So the way it would work is take somebody who grows food or grows hay or something. They need more water because as the temperature goes up, the evaporation rate goes up. So for producing the same amount of food, they have to now put more water in their fields. At the same time, everybody's feeling hot, so they are filling up their swimming pools or their... So the water consumption all over starts to increase. And that in itself puts a lot more stress. So everybody starts to feel the stress of water. So similarly, as we talked about, if it gets hot, there's more carbon dioxide, and maybe there is more rain, let's say, the forest grows. And in one season, you get this beautiful rain, all the greenery comes back, and next two seasons, it becomes dry. Now you have forest fires, which basically, again, take out a whole chunk of the forest. So now you have the erosion problem. So all these things are coupled. And the thing is, you don't want to accelerate the cycle because it's like nature has a way of dealing with things, of regenerating. But when you keep pushing it beyond a certain level of regeneration, it just then cascades and runs out of control.
One way that there's a lot of different metaphors that you can use to think of it, but one is you need 8 hours of sleep, and that's when you restore yourself.
And 2 days you can go with 6 hours.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And a few days you can go with 5 hours, but if you go with 4 hours and then three and then two and then one and then none for weeks, you're completely screwed.
Yes.
We're talking to Rajan Gupta and Greg Swift about energy, climate, and economic development issues. Now, we could talk for another 17 shows about the actual problems that we're seeing in the oceans and the forests and rivers and in people's lives and the economics of it. But let's talk about some solutions and kind of where we're at. I mean, you are both physicists from Los Alamos, and I know you, for example, Greg, went into clean energy and alternative energy development because that was a really good thing to do in the 1970s when you were...
At that time, I think I was personally largely motivated by being raised to believe that waste is a sin and believing that energy efficiency was a moral good. And that coincided well with the spirit of the times, which was shortly after the Arab oil embargo, when the country as a whole feared dependence on foreign oil sources and wanted to become more energy efficient. And here we are today, decades later, and we still use about twice as much energy per capita as any of the other countries that we would think of as comparably prosperous, like Europe or Japan. So the low-hanging fruit in using less fossil energy in America is efficiency of use.
Now, to what extent is the set of solutions that we really need in order to avoid the worst climate catastrophe? We're going to have some catastrophes. You can't just completely avoid it. But avoiding the worst case scenario, to what extent is the solution political and to what extent is it technological? Do we have all the technology we need and we just need our political systems to function properly, or are there still breakthroughs that need to be made, or some of both?
So I think the answer is not a simple yes or no. So what I would say is that we have sufficient technology to make a very significant impact on our footprint. We don't have the full technology. If you said we want to stabilize the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere at 390 parts per million.
Or 350, as Bill McKibben is
striving for. Yes, bring it down to 350. We don't have the technology today to do that because that requires shutting down all fossil fuel, essentially. I mean, bringing it down to the level of a few billion tons from 30, 40 billion tons. So that technology we don't have. Or we don't have the capacity to install and build it. But there are many, many things we can do. So, for example, in my own household, I did a calculation. A largest, my emissions come from the gas furnace, which heats the water in my house. And there's no reason in New Mexico that I could not have a solar water heater, which provides a very large fraction of the hot water needs, both for heating of the house in winter and for hot, just domestic hot water usage. But the problem is that this kind of technology is best done when you're building the house. So you're not first putting in a expense of putting in a fossil fuel based boiler and then taking it out and putting in a solar thing.
Right.
We've known about this for 15 years or 30 years. But the problem is if you hire a contractor to build the house, they are not familiar with this technology. They rather put in a gas-fired boiler because that's what they have done for 30 years. So here is a clear example of a technology that exists, but the part lack of familiarity and the lack of, I would say even competence or training, training is the better word, of both or education and training of the homeowner and of the builder, that those systems are not being put into place. Second, there are no incentives. And that's where politics comes in. Regulations, incentives, tax breaks. Had they done those, there would be an incentive for the builders to learn the new methods. There would be awareness in the public. Hey, I can save money by doing this, just like they're doing it for solar panels today. So people who have the money are seeing, hey, it's cost effective. Let's put them in.
Because eventually these things pay for themselves.
Right. So another example is the whole development of Rio Rancho. If you look at it in the terms of the total population of the state, that's almost 5 to 8% of the entire population of New Mexico.
Lives in Rio Rancho?
Yeah, it's about 100 to 150,000 people. And the total population of the state is about 2 million or less than 2 million.
Okay.
That whole development, if you drive through it, is not built to make use of solar, because the streets and the whole zoning is not east-west. The roofs are not aligned or the things so that they can collect solar efficiently. And you drive by, there is very few houses, if any at all, which have solar hot water systems or solar panels and stuff. So here is something which we've done in the last 10 years. And completely missed a golden opportunity of being energy conscious.
And I mean, and just simply orientation toward the sun, if you have big south-facing windows, you save a ton in energy bills and in
right.
carbon in the winter.
Right. Yeah.
And insulation.
Yes, insulation.
Yeah. And shades to yes. put over yes. those same windows in
yes.
the summer.
Right.
Yes.
And if you look at cost-effective, most people say, oh, these things are too expensive. The cost of shades, and Greg has just done this, so he should talk more, by just making sure that the shades seal the window, he changed his R factor from 2 of those windows to 5.
Yeah, there are window shades now that look great, that change a double-pane window, which has a thermal resistance of about R2. Into an R5 package. It has to do with tricky little seals along the edges of the shades when they're down. They look great, and it's the kind of thing that we've known how to do for decades, and we just haven't been doing it because energy has been so cheap. We haven't been motivated to do it.
Well, and then there's we've known how to do it. Well, maybe you guys have known how to do it, but I mean, there's really a big educational component that needs to be considered in this.
Right. Yeah. So that's what I was saying. See, education, which is where, again, state government can come in. This can become part of courses. This can become part of a public campaign and this can become part of incentives. This is how you promote education. So that's the public. So I take my own personal example. I worked when we were building our house, we worked with an architect who's renowned for his awareness of energy-efficient buildings, Ed Masri, who's built many houses and many buildings in Santa Fe. And he gave us an R factors, and we have a much smaller heating bill. So, yes, we put in some extra money in the construction, but it's paying for itself over time. It's aesthetically better. The sense of the house, the comfort, is much better because you're not over-air conditioning it or overheating it. So all these things are benefits which come with just thought. But at that point, this was 1995, the whole solar technology was not there. The whole hot water technology was there but was not being practiced. And at this point, that's one of the key things, is that unless the contractors, the building tradesmen, become familiar and they see the same opportunity in terms of profit, ease of construction, timeliness of construction, the repair record, they will not voluntarily adopt these new technologies. So one of the things I think which the state can do is that they license contractors, and as part of that licensing, they can request that we will provide the education. By we mean some mechanism within the state that they can be on a yearly basis made aware of new opportunities, what it will cost, so that there is the builder, the contractor, the companies that sell this material, they all get together and say, look, here I can guarantee you for $100, I will provide you with this service. So then the builder or the subcontractor says, okay, I know what my cost is now, I can put this in versus that. And that dialogue between the architects, between the builders, and between the public is what will allow us to transform and make our entire communities energy efficient.
Now, we're talking about something that's very important, which is the local scale. I mean, local being the state of New Mexico, a sunny state with not a whole lot of water, but all this huge amount of energy coming from the sky, and the ability to make use of that, and something very practical, educating contractors and home builders to actually know what they are, what's available, so they can give it to their clients. Let's zoom way out and look at the global picture. We have a world in which the vast majority of people are not living anything like middle-class lifestyles, nor perhaps is that even sustainable in anyone's imagination. But we have what is called the developing world, in which people want and need, and as you said, deserve to use more energy. And an ever-increasing population. How do you think about that in terms of the need to reduce tremendously our carbon footprint?
It seems to me that we have responsibility as the most prosperous nation on Earth to take the lead in developing non-fossil sources of energy and good energy efficiency solutions, and then making those available to the world, so that the...
I thought China was already doing that.
They are doing pretty well. They're building a lot of coal-fired power plants, but they're also building a lot of solar hot water systems and photovoltaic systems, and they're developing very, very quickly. There are, as you said, billions of people in the world who want and deserve a better life, and the only proven path to a better life is the one that they see that America and Europe and Japan have followed, which is basically the fossil fuel path. And we really need to try to figure out a way that relies more on wind power and solar power and hydropower and energy efficiency.
We've got just a few minutes left before we have to go, and again, this is a conversation that could and perhaps should go on for many shows, but we've got a few minutes left. Where are the places? I mean, both of you are Los Alamos physicists. Where do you see in the world of science and technology the places where we could really make breakthroughs that would help this climate situation that we're in?
So I think that, again, and this is where economics and the altruism come together. The technical advances where we can really have an impact, I would say, are in two aspects, and where you can clearly see the U.S. has a phenomenal opportunity. One is in what's called control systems. As you put in more solar, as you put in more wind, the whole electric grid and the whole electric system becomes more complicated. So you have whole very sort of complicated control systems which take into account how things are changing, whether the sun is shining, whether there's a cloud in the sky. And these systems are phenomenal economic opportunities. So if we tell a country, say, like Botswana, which has a lot of sun, put in solar plants or solar farms, but they have no way of regulating or balancing out their thing, they will not do it. So if we can provide them with these control systems and train them to use them, which is a huge requirement in terms of an elite class of educated people, which is, again, good, they can move to that. But if you just say, okay, here is solar panels, but we have no way of balancing the load, you're going to fluctuate just like the sun goes up and down, then you have a problem, people will not adopt it. So this is this whole control system. And this is huge business. This is billions and billions of dollars of business. This is not trivial.
Yeah.
And this is where we can excel, because this is relies on computer systems. It relies on very complex mathematical algorithms. And that's where we should shine. The second part where there's tremendous opportunity is in variety of storage systems. So let's say we all know from number of years that if you change the power amount of energy you stored in a battery just by a factor of 3, the transformation to electric cars would be overnight revolutionized. But the problem is that with the current set of batteries, this factor of 3 is unlikely. So you have to think of whole new technologies whereby you want to get that factor of 3. So storage, I think, is the second major area. Because things like solar panels and wind turbines now, they have enough of a market, and you have enough places, predominantly China, which have put in so much industrial capacity that they have brought prices down to where you're not going to get factors of 3 or 4. So storage and these command and control systems, which will allow us to harness solar and wind more effectively, I would say are the two areas, in my opinion.
Electricity is particularly important because about a third of our fossil fuel consumption is petroleum, and most of that is used in our personal cars and pickup trucks. And we've got to cut that back. And so the shift from petroleum-based cars to electric cars is probably coming.
Greg Swift and Rajan Gupta are physicists at Los Alamos National Laboratory. Thank you, gentlemen, so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.